One of my best benefits was that I'm not afraid, because I've had to assure a few people who were interested. And, you know, and those are some of the things I said to them, you know, think of it as you're super healthy. You got this fantastic team of people who are right there to help you to make sure that you get through this. And then there's the whole benefit of what you're doing for somebody else.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the Ajmera Transplant Centre at Toronto General Hospital, Canada's largest and most comprehensive transplant program, performing over 700 transplants annually. I'm your host, Candice. Each episode, we share the powerful stories from transplant recipients and living donors, along with insights and education from leading medical professionals. Welcome to the final episode of this season. Over the past season, we've shared stories of courage, resilience, and the incredible impact of living organ donation. But to close out this season, we're going back to the beginning, to a moment that changed transplant history. 21 years ago, a man walked into Toronto General Hospital with an idea no one had ever acted on before. He wanted to donate a part of his liver to someone he had never met and would likely never know. At the time, anonymous living liver donation simply wasn't done. There were ethical questions, medical concerns, and no established pathway. Many hospitals had just said no. But at UHN, something extraordinary happened. Instead of closing the door, a team of physicians, surgeons, ethicists, coordinators, and healthcare professionals asked a different question. What if this could save lives? They were willing to do the hard work of building something that had never existed before. Together with one determined donor who refused to give up, they created a program that would go on to transform countless lives and inspire more than 100 anonymous living donors in our own program alone. Today, many people know this ripple effect as the Gosling effect. And yes, in this episode, you're going to hear from Kevin Gosling himself, Canada's first anonymous living liver donor, about determination, compassion, and partnership at UHN that made this historical first happen, and how one decision by one person, backed by a hospital willing to lead, helped change the future of transplant forever. This is a story about innovation. It's a story about courage. And most of all, it's a story about what can happen when people are brave enough to do what has never been done before. Welcome to the season finale. Thank you for listening with us. Hello, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
No problem. Glad to be here.
So I'm wondering if we can jump right in, and we're going to bring you all the way back to way back when you started considering the thought of being a living donor. And I'm wondering, you know, when you first had that pull or thought of becoming a donor, what was happening at that time emotionally, you know, personally? How did you get to that thought of, I wonder if I could donate to a stranger?
Well, there wasn't anything in particular going on. It was just little things that I started to see. You know, I've always been on the bone marrow list, and I've always been donating blood. And I knew that organ donations would happen. But what wasn't public was that you could do it without being a full genetic match like it is for bone marrow.
Right.
So in the back of my mind, that's what I always thought. So I never gave it any thought to donate otherwise, right? And it wasn't until my first wife's family had a problem with kidneys.
Oh.
And two of them had to donate their kidneys to their brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, one of them had to have a kidney again. And even my daughter did it. This was well after I had done the donation, but my daughter donated a kidney as well.
Wow.
I was pretty proud of her.
Incredible.
So I, like I said, I started to see little things like within that family, and that got me thinking, well, what about people that don't have a family member? Because I'm still thinking you have to be this genetic match. And so then I started to do a little bit of research on it just because I was curious. And I thought, well, maybe they have a list that they could put me on in case I ever get a genetic match, and I'd be willing to go. And that's when I found out you don't have to be a genetic match anymore. Blood type is the basis of it. And so I thought, oh my goodness, I could do it now to somebody who doesn't have somebody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, I mulled that around in my head without telling anybody because I didn't want anyone to think it was crazy, especially my wife.
Right.
So then, I don't know, one day it just, I started thinking, well, if you're going to do something about this, do it or move on, right? And so I did. I started to talk to my wife and I said, well, what do you think of that? I just add my name and, you know, that'll help everybody else that's on this terrible list. You know, I couldn't, like when I was doing the research and I found out that how many people just in Toronto alone was on a list waiting for organ and that most of them don't make it to the top. And by the time you make it to the top, you're probably too sick for the surgery. So it's terrible odds, right? And so I naively thought, I'm just going to write them a letter and say, listen, I'm available. You know, it's Friday. Let's do it Monday. So
right. Sure. Why not?
It's not that I'm dumb or anything like that. I was just very willing and, you know, honestly willing to do it. Well, I kind of got that door slammed in my face a little bit, kindly, but no, sir, we don't do that. And we have not done that. And, you know, that sort of thing, very politely turned me down. And so then I was a little disappointed because I really naively thought they'd take me next week. So then suddenly there was a newspaper article of a young boy in London at the hospital needing organs. So I sent them another note. And again, they turned me down politely. And they said, well, we're interviewing some of his family. They've come forth. And so I thought, well, that's good. He's getting what he wants. But I still feel bad that I was turned down when I could have helped somebody. So I got a hold of the Ottawa Hospital for sick kids. I thought, well, maybe they'd be willing, right? And so they turned me down also, but only because they don't do the surgeries there. They send the kids to Toronto.
Yes.
And so this time I got a positive response from the person there. They said, well, I know the coordinator in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send him a note and tell him that you're interested and see if he wants to talk. And so that started it. So the next thing you know, I did hear from Toronto. Again, they were very polite and letting me know, we've never done it. This may not go the way you think, but we're at least willing to talk about it because there's been conversation.
Wow.
You want to hear this whole story all in one bite?
Sure. Yes. I mean, it's fascinating to me, you know, the thought process. I think a lot of people on the first time that somebody said, well, we don't do that, they would say, okay, well, you know what? I tried and I'm going to move on. Thanks so much. But, you know, hearing your persistence and advocacy, this is amazing. And I'm so curious, you know, it had never been done at the time, right?
I was never one to give up. Mm-hmm. On things that were important, but I wasn't crazily wanted to do this sort of stuff. It just bothered me a bit that nobody had done it and everybody seems to be fenced into not doing it.
Right.
But I thought I got to pursue this, especially since they were willing to talk. Now I like to talk, so they opened the door.
Incredible. And so what was that talk like? The Toronto General Hospital was willing to at least hear you out. Why does this man want to donate to a stranger?
Right. So I got invited to an interview. And so I went there, stayed overnight, and I learned an awful lot that I did not know or understand. You know, most of the misinformation was with me, not knowing why they're apprehensive for doing that. And so that kind of even made me more determined.
I love it.
Because all these stumbling blocks they had, I felt that I was the type of person that would work with them to get rid of those. You know, so we went through the whole conversations. Is this guy nuts? Is he trying to atone for something he's done in the past? There's lots I should atone for, but that wasn't it. But, you know, when they started explaining all that to me, you know, I really felt like, you know, we could work on this, get rid of all of your fears and accomplish something really wonderful here because it would start others. My big thing was I kept thinking about that seniority list, right? And I thought, if I just jump in and hand my liver, basically, to somebody, everybody else moves up the list. And moving up that one spot could make the difference of whether you live or not, you know? And so I kept thinking about things like that. So that really helped motivate me, right? Also, I've always been good at, how would I put that, challenges and standing up for something that's important to me, but in a nice way, not an argumentative way, you know?
Like, yeah.
So everything started to fall in place, but it took a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I did learn a lot of things about their methods of determining whether you really deep down want to go forward.
Right.
And one of the things they did was they said, well, we'll get back to you. And then they didn't for months. And I didn't want to feel like I was pressuring them or something like this. So Christmas came, and then I said, I'm going to give them till New Year's. And so then after New Year's, I contacted them, and I said, why have you not gotten back to me? Why has it been so long? And they said, honestly, we wanted to give you a chance to just back out.
Wow.
Quietly, you know, so you're not bothered by it, because they've had lots of others who have. And that was for family members.
Right.
Here is somebody trying to do it for a stranger. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a chance he's going to back out of this.
Right. Maybe this was a New Year's resolution that he thought he could do, and now it's over.
You never know, right?
Yeah.
It's a good idea, and then it goes away, or life happens, and you can't do it anymore, and you want a quiet way to get out. You know, they were really good about making me feel comfortable that up to the day of surgery, I could back out without having a problem. They would find an excuse for me, you know, to tell others. But it can be just as simple as I've changed my mind.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that was really comforting.
Yeah.
You know, it really made you feel like they were looking out for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I went through all the interviews, and I went through a lot of different types of people that I didn't know existed, like a bioethicist. I had never heard of that. Met up with two of them. They were great. I love what they do, you know. And surgeons tell me right out, I don't agree with this. You know, we say we do no harm, and this would do you harm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even just the ordinary surgery and everything.
Right.
If something went wrong, then it's a big harm, right?
Mm-hmm.
But things like that don't bother me. You know, maybe it should. I mean, I look at it logically, but it doesn't bother me. I've had some big surgeries since then, not because of my liver.
Mm-hmm.
Other parts falling apart, old.
We all are, right?
Yeah. So anyways, I liked talking to them, mm-hmm. especially the surgeons in that, because we could have a real honest, serious conversation about it.
Right.
So that they could feel comfortable if they needed to change their mind. I knew I was not going to change my mind, but they didn't know that.
Right.
And, you know, when I was talking to you, like I said, if we remove the things that you're afraid of,
mm-hmm.
then this all becomes possible again.
Amazing.
It was an interesting process. I enjoyed it to some extent, mm-hmm. you know, because I learned a lot. It was a little bit taxing physically, having to go back and forth to Toronto because I'm 4.5 hours away.
Right.
So every time we wanted to have a meeting or they wanted to have a test done or this sort of stuff, I had to do all that traveling. That's why it cost me so much.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, there was no funding.
Right.
That was another good thing that came out of that.
Yes.
They ended up creating a fund because they asked me, keep track of all the expenses. We're going to try to drive some changes in legislation. And it did. So that was good.
Wow. And during this time when you're going through, you know, our donors go through the process of the workup to see if they will be eligible to donate. But it's a very methodical, streamlined process that it has been done hundreds of times now with our donors, and we know the pathway forward now, you know, in 2026. You know, last year we had 79 living donors who went through that process, right? So, you know, so much has changed since you went through this. When you were going through those steps, you know, it took so long to get to that point where they said, you know what, we're going to take this risk and we're going to do this if you're still on board.
Mm-hmm.
What were those conversations that you were having with your family during this time about, no, I'm going to continue to push, I'm going to continue to do this? What were they thinking through this process?
I was very fortunate that my family was very supportive and sort of nonchalant about it, at least with me. Maybe they had conversations when I wasn't there, you know, but my wife was terribly supportive. She wanted to also put her name on the list at the beginning when I thought there was a list.
Yeah.
But at the time she was having some medical issues. And so we decided that she'll wait until after this and then decide, right? And later she got diabetes and wasn't allowed to donate. And that's the same thing happened to me when I wanted to donate a kidney after this.
Mm-hmm.
When they started testing me, they found that I had to develop diabetes. Wow. So I didn't get to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But the family was great. And like I said, they were very supportive. And maybe it's genetic that we're not all worried about those sort of things. Some people, they panic when it comes to medical things,
yes.
Right?
For sure. It's a scary thing.
And I was very fortunate that my family didn't feel that way, because if they had, it would have been difficult to do it with all of them not wanting that to happen.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm sure they didn't hope that something would happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when I say no.
Yeah.
But no, they were, I was very lucky to have them behind me.
Amazing.
So much.
Amazing. And so, you know, being, again, I keep going back to this idea of being the first, but, you know, when we're thinking about taking those risks and doing things for the first time and making a change in this world, it can feel lonely. It can feel like there's a lot of pressure, you know, to push through. And you sound like the type of person that wasn't going to take no for an answer very easily, right? That you were continuing to advocate for all of these people who don't have a family member or friend who can step up. You get to that end of all of these conversations and they say, all right, you know what? We're willing to take this risk. Let's do it. Are you still on board? You know, how do you feel when they said, we're willing to do it if you were as well?
It was definitely a relief.
Mm.
A relief that I didn't have to fight so much more. But I was a little bit emotional about the fact that we're going to be able to do it. You know, we're going to help not one, a whole bunch of people in that lineup because they move up, but also other people will come forward because they don't know it's even possible. So you can't expect that, right? I remember standing in the window at the hospital looking outside and I see all these people walking up and down the street and I'm thinking, so many of all of them that are healthy enough and could contribute and we could literally wipe out this. That's maybe a little unrealistic, but it also is true. You know, and so, you know, the fact that we were starting this, I knew, or I really hoped, that it was going to spin off. Now, it took a long time to spin off because we weren't allowed to talk about it or advertise it for a year, which was smart because, you know, they literally had to make sure that I live because it's not a good story if I didn't. And, I'm assuming the same thing with the person who got my liver, because I had no idea if it was a boy or a girl or their age or what was wrong with them or anything like that, which was all part of the anonymous business.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they approached me a year later and they said, do you mind if we do a story about this? Everything has gone well. We'd like to promote it and try to get others. And that was great. I thought that was a good idea. You know, not that I wanted to be in the papers anymore, you know. I'm not the famous one in the family. My nephew is.
Right.
He didn't donate any organs, but he dances pretty good.
Right? Yeah. Yes. In our world, you're the famous one.
Oh, yeah. That's true. That's true. But it's a small world, right?
Yes.
Oh.
Amazing.
So,
and so, you know, people actually, it may be wild to you or may even be unknown, but people actually call it the Gosling effect.
Yeah, I heard that, but I'd never heard it until you guys started talking about it.
You never heard that before?
No.
So the Gosling effect is really that ripple effect of what you've created because you decided to step forward and be the first anonymous liver donor. And, you know, that wave of people who have been impacted since that donation. I'm wondering if you ever realized, or, you know, maybe it took years to see this, but how did it feel when you first realized that your choice was influencing other people?
Well, like I said, I didn't get to start thinking about that until after a year before. And when they approached one of the newspapers in Toronto to do the story, and on the day of that story being released, they brought me to Toronto, me and my wife, and they were going to have this news interview thing with all of these cameras and news agencies, which I did not expect, right? And of course, that's when they decide to give me a letter that the recipient's family wrote for me. So this was the first time I heard anything about them. Still didn't know if it was a boy or a girl, still didn't know the age, but they did thank me, you know, for doing it, which they didn't have to do. That wasn't all part of the whole thing. And of course, they read me this in front of all the cameras and everybody else. So I lost it, you know. I always lose it anyways. I can't watch cartoons unless if somebody does something nice for somebody else, I'm sniffing and my granddaughter's handing me a box of Kleenex and stuff like this. I feel it when people do good things, I guess, which is not a bad trait. But it was then when that spread out because, you know, the news likes a good story once in a while, right? If somebody doing something nice, it went everywhere, you know? I had phone calls from people all over the world asking radio stations asking me to do an interview at 2 o'clock in the morning my time because of the time over where they are, you know? And so I did lots of newspaper interviews and this sort of stuff, which was great because I really felt like we started a ball rolling and I'm just helping to push it a little bit further, you know? I knew that that would run out, but that's okay. I wasn't looking for that in the first place, you know?
Yeah.
And over the years, again, like every 5 years, there'd be a little bit more about it, you know, another story to try to keep organ donation in people's minds, which is great. Like this. Mm-hmm. This is going to be great, you know? But it was 21 years ago. It's amazing how long ago it was, you know? And the boy that got my liver, if everything went okay, and I don't know that, you know, that's all right. Part of the, I wonder about that once in a while, but it's okay. If you got any time at all, I'm happy. It was worth it, especially with everything else that went on, right? But he would be around 31 years old now.
Wow.
And the only way I found out he's a boy and that he was 10 was they did a journal story for the medical journal story. And I had to approve what they were putting in there. And so it said in there that it was a boy and he was 10 years old. I said, oh, now we know, you know, which didn't matter, but it was cute to know, you know?
Yeah. And thinking about that recipient, you know, there is not just a boy out there who has grown into a man and, you know, now had a full life because of that liver transplant, but his entire family has been impacted by that donation and his community. And like you said, the people behind him on the wait list who were waiting for a deceased donor who couldn't get a living donor. And this impact that one person has on the entire community. You know, how does that make you feel to know that you were part of that catalyst?
You know, I often thought, you know, this is going to make a big difference, all that sort of stuff, you know, but every once in a while you get hit with something that deeply moves you, right? I'll tell you a little story. When I was in the hospital, I had my surgery done. They were trying to hide me so that the story wouldn't get out. So they put me with people who have received organs. They keep them in different sections of the hospital, I guess, right? So I'm in there not really knowing that. And I decide to go for a walk with my cart and all the tubes and everything else like this. And I meet up with a guy, both me and my wife meet up with this guy who's walking around with his tubes and stuff like that. And so he starts to talk and he says, did you just get your liver transplanted too? I go, no. I said, I'm not that. I says, I just donated one. His whole face changed. He just stopped in his tracks and he started to cry. And he says, oh my God, you're one of those angels. And it just made me full of shivers because suddenly I realized just how bad he was and how grateful he was that he got a liver and that he's going to get to live, because I seen some awfully sick people in that hospital that needed donations, you know. But it just all came together at that moment. It was very personal, not so broad. It's going to help everybody, you know, helped him, you know, sort of thing, right? And so that was it. Me and my wife, we continued down the hall crying, went back to the room, you know. So it's great when you have those real personal parts of it that show up. Now, it's not all the time. I don't think about it all the time sort of thing. You know, it was 21 years ago, right? But, you know, there's been a few profound moments along the way, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. And you're right. You know, you might not have met the person that you donated to, but being able to see that impact, right? Like right in front of your face, walking down the hall, yep. Both of you holding onto your poles in your gowns.
Yeah,
you
know, cute. Both.
Yeah, right. Both have your hair done nice. But, right. You know, how that person felt, maybe, you know, they hadn't been able to see their donor yet to say thank you. And here's a donor standing in front of them. And I can personally attest, you know, I've had my kidney now for 16 years. And the things that I can list, like off of a resume of the things that I've been able to do because of that transplant and the life that I've had because of it, is because of somebody, a living donor, who said, I'm willing to do this. I'm willing to risk part of my life to save yours. There's no greater gift in the entire world that someone can give than to give life, right?
It's hard to be thankful enough when you're thinking about it, you know? Like in my end of things, I didn't receive something, but I got to do something very profound, right? And it wasn't easy, like, oh, you just did it on the weekend sort of thing. This took well over a year, you know, a lot of fighting, sort of, that sort of stuff, you know. So it's very profound that we got to have an opportunity to do that, because it forever changes you, mm-hmm. you know. I had lots of people phone me. How they got my phone number, I don't know. We didn't advertise it, but it's easy to find somebody. So I had people calling me all the time. And they wanted to tell me that I'm thinking about doing that and this sort of stuff. Who do I contact? And I thought that was great, right?
Yes.
But the hospital also warned me about not everybody has, I don't want to say good intentions. They don't have the right intentions for doing it, you know? And I mentioned earlier as a joke, they wanted to know if I wanted to atone for something. And they really were asking, you know?
Yeah.
The funniest part was they said, do you want to write a book? And I said to them, if you see my spelling, you would know I'm never going to write a book. But I did have this one person call me and started asking me about the donation, what it was like and stuff like that, and said that he was thinking about doing the same thing and who does he contact, okay?
Yeah.
And so I gave him the contact information, but I also called the coordinator to let him know he was going to call.
Mm-hmm.
Because his intentions was, he did something very bad, went to prison for a lot of years, came out now, and wanted to do something to literally atone for what he had done.
Wow.
Now, in one sense, he's maybe thankful. You know, it's a good thing he wants to atone. It's always a good thing. But it may not be the right motivation, because that can go away, and here you are donating. You know, like, and so they're very leery of those kind of intentions.
Yeah. For sure.
So I got some strange calls.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, you would, right? With that impact that goes out there. Yeah. Amazing. You know, when I talk to donors, they're all different aspects of donors and why they do it and, you know, what their purpose and who they're donating to. But sometimes, you know, it feels different when I talk to anonymous donors. And I'm wondering if to you, the fact that it is anonymous has changed the meaning of your gift. Like, did it feel different? Did it feel more universal in scope, I guess, because you're donating it out into the world versus a singular person? I'm wondering if that kind of changed how you felt about your gift.
So I guess maybe you're thinking bigger picture, whereas other people, they're thinking very personal, which is understandable and great. But if you want to be an anonymous one, you know, it ends up being you're thinking of a bigger picture. You don't have to know that person. You're just, you know, throwing it in the pool, for lack of better words. And so that makes you think differently, you know, but I'm not always thinking deeply. That's not me. I'm mostly joking all the time, right? So having these profound moments, it's usually somebody like you that asks me a question. And I said, well, let me think about how I felt then, you know, because whenever I was doing all the interviews, I think that's something that struck them as strange, is that I wasn't deeply thinking about what I was doing. I just genuinely thought, it's a good idea. I'm healthy. I'm willing. You're in need. Let's get together, you know? And I can understand why most people wouldn't have that feeling, but there's got to be other people who would.
Mm-hmm.
And there has been.
There has been, yes.
I don't know how many there has been, but it isn't just, like, if you look at the amount of people that at Toronto, they've had anonymous donors come up. This is all the other hospitals across Canada, you know, and this sort of stuff that would start doing it that weren't doing it before, you know? So it could be a very large spinoff, you know?
Mm-hmm. And even in our program, we have over 100, right? Who have done it in our program.
That's amazing. I was hoping you knew that number.
Yeah. We've had over 100. There's actually a paper that will be coming out shortly all about our anonymous program and, you know, the numbers and all of those facts that have come out over the last 20 years. And, you know, it's remarkable to think, you know, you're a very humble person, but you are the pioneer of this, right? You are the one who said, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep pushing and do this because it matters to me and it's going to matter to somebody else.
I noticed you use the word pioneer. Is that because I'm old? You know, we were talking about, did I want to write a book? Of course I didn't, right? But I am in a book.
Amazing. The Organ Donor Experience.
Yes. It's about a lady who's a bioethicist, mm-hmm. I think. Is that what it is? And she travels all over the world studying stories of people who do something that's profoundly, how is that, altruistic?
Altruistic, yeah.
And so there's a whole bunch of chapters here, and each one is about somebody who did something like that, but not always about organ donation, other things.
Beautiful.
And so she approached me, and we had a lovely talk about a few things, and I got a chapter.
I will link that in our podcast notes as well, so people can take a look at that. I'm wondering too, Kevin, you know, you're 21 years out. Do you still look at your scar? Does your scar mean anything to you?
I generally don't see it unless I'm taking a bath and I'm laying down and I can see my belly, you know, because it is a pretty big happy face, you know, so that my little grandchildren were calling it my happy face on my belly, you know, which is where I got that term.
I love that.
But it makes you stop and think for a few minutes because you haven't thought about it in a long time, you know, but I don't have any negative issues with it or anything like that. That's good. The rest of my body's falling apart, but. I know what I wanted to tell you. I got a story. My wife and I were out yard sailing one day. Okay. And we were in a town, just a few towns from here. And here somebody's having a big yard sale, a bunch of ladies there helping out. And so I walk in and I'm looking for stuff. And then I notice their sign and it says that the money collected is going towards organ donation.
Wow.
Okay. And And so I look at the sign and I tell the girl, I said, oh, that's funny. I says, I've donated half my liver. She says, oh, really? When? And I told her, it was way back when. Apparently I was the first one. She goes, you're Kevin. Just like that.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, all the others come running. You're the first. And they knew all about my story and me and stuff like that. It was quite an experience. All of a sudden, you got a bunch of fans. You didn't even know them, right? Next thing you know, I'm up in Ottawa going to a couple of their meetings. And we all went and donated blood together at the same time one night.
Wow.
There's so many things that I could be involved in, but because of all my other family responsibilities, I have to limit those things that I'm involved in, right? But that was just so unusual that all of a sudden they all knew me, you know, when I'm thinking nobody knows me, you know, like, which is okay.
Yes. Yes. Amazing. And I mean, definitely in our world, we all know you as, you know, our, like I said, jokingly, not because of age, pioneer. But because of, your pioneer and, you know, blazing this amazing trail for other people to follow and to look to as, you know, such a light in this life that, you know, sometimes it can be hard to find things that are inspiring and, you know, with our constant barrage of news, sometimes it can feel like the world may not be a lovely place all the time, but, you know, getting to talk to living donors and people like you just remind us that, you know, there is real good in the world and real good in people that actually exists.
I'm going to cry.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, I'm wondering if there's somebody who is out there and they're listening to our podcast, or, you know, maybe they have looked into organ donation and they're curious. What advice would you give to other potential living donors if they're curious about this?
It's a pretty wonderful feeling. It's one that you have inside yourself that's private to a certain point, you know, because of what you did, you know, and, one of my best benefits was that I'm not afraid. So for people that are going to do this, if they're already afraid, that's different. Then we have to have a talk about how the fact that you're healthy and you're going to have this surgery. It was amazing how quick I was back to 100% normal, if I could ever be normal, you know? That, cause I've had to assure a few people who were interested. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and those are some of the things I said to them, you know, think of it as you're super healthy. You got this fantastic team of people who are right there to help you to make sure that you get through this without being harmed. And then there's the whole benefit of what you're doing for somebody else. You know, I had this big guy at work who you think would not be afraid of anything. And he come up to me after he found out, are you an idiot? He says, I can never do that. Never do that. And he says, why would you do that? He says, all the risk you're taking and stuff like this. And I told him, I says, I kind of look at this as, think of a little child coming down a river, going underneath the bridge, and you see her. She's going to drown. Would you not just jump in and help her? Well, yeah, I would, you know. And I said, well, you're taking a whole bunch of risk when you do that, you know, but you did that and you helped them and they got to the shore and you saved them. I says, what I'm doing is I know somebody's coming down that river ahead of time. I know who they are, when they're coming, what's wrong with them. I have a whole team of people sitting on that shore waiting for me to jump in, do my little thing and bring her to the shore. They're going to help her. They're going to help me. You know, it's a great big team of people all helping to do that little thing. That my part's small after a while, you know. And he says, that's a really good way of looking at that. He says, I still wouldn't do it. It's not for everybody, but for many people, it's surprising. It is for you and you can do it. And it's a wonderful feeling.
Wow. Incredible. It's amazing. It's so incredible to get to hear your story and how you still feel about all of this. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like to share with our listeners?
I don't know. I ramble on too much about so many things, you know. It's when I was reading one of the things I did, I sent it to you, was keep an order of all the things that happened, because you're never going to remember all that stuff. And so I would remember some of those things. And I said, geez, I forgot all about that, you know, and that was such a wonderful feeling, you know. So if anybody else goes through this, write it all down as it happens, because so many things happen and so many of them are wonderful and can be used to help other people, but also just to help yourself. I'm so glad I did that now, especially with my memory going.
I'll ask you one more before we go. You know, thinking about the world of transplant and the world in general, is there something that you're hopeful for the future, for your grandkids, for your great-grandkids, and, you know, what's to come?
Wow. I'm always hopeful, you know, and I'm always looking at the things that come, like with AI and the new types of computers, the amazing things they're going to be able to do, as well as I'm not naive. I know that there's a lot of bad stuff that's going to come with that, so that we have to be weary. But I think there's going to be great things happen with the whole organ donation thing in the future. It will either become a whole lot easier to do and less things going wrong. The whole idea of it possibly that we can grow an organ and stuff like that, I can't see why that eventually won't be successful, because, you know, not everybody's concentrating on it at the moment, but there are other people who are. And with the whole AI business, that could really help change that. So they're needing less and less people to donate, you know, that sort of stuff. So I'm hopeful. I have a bright outlook for the future. You know, I just know I'm not going to be there, unfortunately. You know, unless medicine gets a lot better.
Right. Well, that's lovely. Oh. Yes. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk about this journey and for all of the times you've discussed it, you know, over the last 20 some years. And that probably is not going to stop anytime soon, because like I said, you know, we have the Gosling effect because of you and all of these anonymous donors who have saved lives because of your advocacy and your push to make this happen. So, you know, on behalf of all of us recipients and, you know, everyone who has gone through this, thank you so much for what you've done for the world and for the future of all of us recipients who need.
Well, thanks for asking and thanks for what you're doing. You know, you guys that are out there fighting the good fight, it's wonderful what you're doing, and you're making a much bigger effect than I am. Even though it's in a different way, you can reach a whole lot more people.
Thank you, Kevin. I truly appreciate it. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.